at dinner, bin Laden unexpectedly began boasting about al-Qaeda. He said he was convinced that the Americans could be easily driven out of the Arabian Peninsula. He gave the example of Yemen. "We hit them in Aden and they left," he said proudly. "We hit them in Somalia and they left again."
"Osama, this is very dangerous," Jamal replied. "It is as if you are declaring war. You will give the right to the Americans to hunt for you."
Bin Laden just smiled. Again, Khashoggi pulled out his tape recorder. Again, his friend declined to speak on the record. The following night, Khashoggi came to dinner for the last time. They sat once more on the floor of the terrace. It was exactly the same simple meal he had enjoyed the previous nights, rice and lamb. Bin Laden sometimes ate with a spoon, but he preferred to use the fingers of his right hand, because it was sunnah, the way the Prophet did it. He rhapsodized about how much he missed Medina and how he would like to go back and settle there. Khashoggi responded that all he had to do was state on the record what he had already said privately, that he renounced the use of violence. Just then, someone approached bin Laden and whispered in his ear. Osama stood up and went into the garden. In the shadows, Khashoggi could see two or three men quietly speaking in Egyptian accents. 5 minutes later, bin Laden returned, and Khashoggi posed the question again. "What will I get for that?" bin Laden asked. Khashoggi was caught by surprise. Osama had never acted like a politician before, negotiating for a personal advantage. "I don't know," Khashoggi admitted. "I'm not representing the government. Just say something, break the ice. Maybe there will be a positive reaction. Don't forget, you said a few nasty things about the kingdom." Bin Laden smiled. "Yes, but a move like that has to be calculated." He aired a couple of possible sweeteners, a full pardon for him, a timetable for the complete withdrawal of the American forces from the peninsula. Khashoggi had the feeling that his friend was losing his hold on reality. Bin Laden began to speak fondly about Sudan, saying what great investment opportunities there were. He asked Khashoggi about a couple of mutual friends and suggested that they should come investigate the agricultural prospects. He would be happy to show them around.
"Osama, any Saudi person would be afraid to be seen with you in public," said Jamal. "Why can't you see that?"
Bin Laden just gave him the same old smile that Khashoggi had always seen. He didn't seem to realize what he had done or become in the eyes of his compatriots. Exasperated, Khashoggi told bin Laden that he was going to leave the next day. If Osama wanted to do the interview, he should call him at the Hilton. Bin Laden never called. Chapter 11. The Prince of Darkness. On a Sunday morning in February 1995, Richard A. Clark, the National Coordinator for Counterterrorism in the White House, went to his office to review intelligence cables that had come in over the weekend. One of the reports noted that Ramzi Youssef, the suspected mastermind behind the World Trade Center bombing 2 years earlier, had been spotted in Islamabad. Clark immediately called FBI headquarters, although in his experience there was rarely anyone there on Sundays. A man whose voice was unfamiliar to him answered the phone.
"O'Neill," he growled.
"Who are you?"
Clark asked. "I'm John O'Neill," the man replied. "Who the fuck are you?"
O'Neill had just been appointed chief of the FBI's counterterrorism section. He had been transferred from the Bureau's Chicago office. After driving all night, he had gone directly to headquarters that Sunday morning without dropping off his bags. Alone in the massive J. Edgar Hoover building, except for security guards, O'Neill was not even supposed to start work until the following Tuesday. Clark informed him that Ramzi Youssef, the FBI's most wanted terrorist, had tripped a wire 9,000 miles away. It was now O'Neill's responsibility to put together a team that would bring the suspect back to New York, where he had been indicted for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and a conspiracy to bomb American airliners. O'Neill walked down the empty hallway and opened the Strategic Information and Operations Center, SIOC, or SIOC. The windowless room is set up for secure video conferences with the White House, the State Department, and other branches of the FBI. It is the nerve center of the Bureau, open only during emergencies. O'Neill began making calls. He wouldn't leave FBI headquarters for the next 3 days. A rendition, as the Bureau terms the legal kidnapping of suspects in foreign lands, is a complex and time-consuming procedure usually planned months in advance. O'Neill would need an airplane to fly the suspect home. Because of the $2 million reward on Yusuf's head, there had been a flood of false reports concerning his whereabouts, so one of O'Neill's first concerns was to make sure he actually had his man. He would have to have a fingerprint expert, whose job would be to determine that the suspect was, in fact, Ramzi Yusuf. He needed a medical doctor to attend Yusuf in case he was injured or had some unknown condition that required treatment. He would have to push the State Department to get permission from the Pakistani government to perform the snatch immediately. Under ordinary circumstances, the host country would be asked to detain the suspect until extradition paperwork had been signed and the FBI could place the man in custody. There was no time for that. Yusuf was planning to board a bus for Peshawar in a few hours. Unless he was quickly apprehended, he would soon be over the Khyber Pass and into Afghanistan, out of reach. Gradually, the room filled with agents in casual weekend clothes or church-going finery. A contingent from the New York office flew in. They would be the ones to make the actual arrest if Yusuf was captured, since he had been indicted in their district. For many of the agents in the room, O'Neill was an unfamiliar face, and no doubt it was odd to be suddenly taking orders from a man they had never before met. But most had heard of him. In a culture that favors discreet anonymity, O'Neill cut a memorable figure. Darkly handsome, with slick back hair, winking black eyes, and a big round jaw, O'Neill talked tough, in a New Jersey accent that many loved to imitate. He had entered the Bureau in the J. Edgar Hoover era, and throughout his career he had something of the old-time G-man about him. He wore a thick pinky ring and carried a 9mm automatic strapped to his ankle. He favored Chivas Regal and water with a twist, along with a fine cigar. His manner was bluff and profane, but his nails were buffed, and he was always immaculately, even fussily dressed, black double-breasted suits, semi-transparent black socks, and shiny loafers as supple as ballet slippers, a nightclub wardrobe, as one of his colleagues labeled it. He had wanted to work for the Bureau since boyhood, when he watched Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. star as the button-down Inspector Lewis Erskine in the TV series The FBI. He got a job as a fingerprint clerk with the Bureau as soon as he graduated from high school in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and he put himself through American University and a master's program in forensics at George Washington University by serving as a tour guide at FBI headquarters. In 1976, he became a full-time agent in the Bureau's office in Baltimore, and in 1991, he was named Assistant Special Agent in charge of the Chicago office. Nicknames, Satan, the Prince of Darkness, followed him around from his days in Chicago, which spoke about his remorseless intensity, his sleeplessness, and the fear that he often inspired in those who worked with him. Time meant little to him. He kept the shades down in his office and seemed to live in eternal night. In Sayoc, O'Neill walked around with a phone at each ear, coordinating the rendition team on one line and arranging for an Air Force transport on the other. Because Pakistan would not permit an American military aircraft to land on its soil, O'Neill ordered the Air Force to paint its jet in civilian colors immediately. He also demanded that if Yusuf was captured, the flight home would be refueled in mid-air, fearing that Yusuf might claim asylum if the aircraft had to land in another country. O'Neill was operating well outside his authority, but he was reckless and domineering by nature. The Pentagon later sent him a bill for $12 million for the mid-air refueling and the paint job. The bill went unpaid. As the news spread of Yusuf's sighting, Attorney General Janet Reno and the director of the FBI, Louis Free, came into SIOC. Many critical operations had been conducted in this room, but none so urgent and complex. The policy of renditions had only recently been instituted through an executive order that extended the reach of the FBI outside the borders of the United States, turning it into an international police agency. In practice, however, the Bureau was still learning not only how to operate in foreign environments, but also how to beat a path through the U.S. government agencies abroad, each of which needed to be bullied or appeased. Such diplomacy normally required lengthy negotiations, but there was no time for talk. If Yusuf escaped, few doubted that he would attempt to carry out his scheme of blowing up American airliners, or even crashing a plane into CIA headquarters, as he had once planned. O'Neill got the rendition team in the air, but he still needed to put a snatch team in place. There was only one FBI agent in Pakistan who could be pressed into service. O'Neill located several agents from the Drug Enforcement Administration and the State Department Bureau of Diplomatic Security who were also in the country. They enlisted a couple of Pakistani soldiers and rushed to the motel to grab Yusuf before he got on the bus. At 9:30 a.m. Pakistani time, on February 7th, the agents entered the Su Casa guest house in Islamabad and knocked on the door of room 16. A sleepy Yusuf was immediately thrown to the floor and handcuffed. Moments later, the news reached the jubilant agents at FBI headquarters. During the 3 days he was in SIOC, John O'Neill turned 43 years old. He finally took his luggage to his new apartment. It was Tuesday, his first official day on the job. In Washington, O'Neill became part of a close-knit group of terrorism experts that formed around Dick Clark. In the web of federal agencies concerned with terrorism, Clark was the spider. Everything that touched the web eventually came to his attention. He was the first coordinator for counterterrorism on the National Security Council, a position he crafted for himself through the powerful force of his personality. The members of this inner circle, which was known as the Counterterrorism Security Group, CSG, were drawn mainly from the CIA, the National Security Council, and the upper tiers of the Defense Department, the Justice Department, and the State Department. They met every week in the White House Situation Room. The FBI had always been a problematic member of the CSG. Its representatives tended to be close-mouthed and unhelpful, treating all intelligence as potential evidence that couldn't be compromised, whether there was an actual criminal case or not. O'Neill was different. He cultivated his counterparts in other agencies rather than pulling down the bureaucratic shutters. In Clark's experience, most federal law enforcement officers were dull and slow. By the time they had risen to the upper ranks of management, they were already at their maximum pay rank and were marking time toward their retirement. Against this drab background, O'Neill leaped out, charismatic, improvisatory, outspoken, and intriguingly complicated. Clark and O'Neill were both relentless infighters, and they made enemies easily, but each recognized in the other qualities he could use. Clark had always groomed key allies who protected him against changes in administration and armed him with inside information. After more than 2 decades in government, beginning as a management intern at the Pentagon in 1973, he had protégés scattered all over Capitol Hill. He was brilliant but solitary, living alone in a blue clapboard house in Arlington, Virginia, with azaleas surrounding the front porch and an American flag flying from the second story. He spoke in emphatic, declarative sentences that brooked no argument. Ambitious and impatient, he had little time for life outside of his office on the third floor of the old executive office building, overlooking the west wing of the White House. It was rare that someone interested him as a rival. He could push competitive bureaucrats aside for sport, since he played the game better than all but a few. Although Clark was shrewd and formidable, he was also socially awkward, tending to look past people when he spoke to them. He had the pallor of a redhead, now gone gray, and the tight, inappropriate smile of the super-realist. He spotted O'Neill as someone who shared his obsession about the threat posed by terrorism at a time when few in Washington considered it real. They had in common the resentment of the unprivileged outsider who had escaped the narrow expectations of his upbringing. O'Neill still had a strong whiff of the Jersey streets about him, which Clark, the son of a nurse and a factory worker, valued. And like Clark, O'Neill saw through the political burlesque. The two men worked to establish clear lines of responsibility among the intelligence agencies, which had a long history of savage bureaucratic warfare. In 1995, their efforts resulted in a presidential directive giving the FBI the lead authority in both investigating and preventing acts of terrorism wherever in the world Americans or American interests were threatened. After the bombing in Oklahoma City in April of that year, O'Neill formed a separate section for domestic terrorism, while he concentrated on redesigning and expanding the foreign branch. He organized a swap of deputies between his office and the CIA's Counterterrorist Center, despite resistance from both organizations. To younger agents who gave him what he demanded, which was absolute loyalty, he became a kind of consigliere. In the fiefdoms of the Bureau, O'Neill was a powerful sponsor. He would often put his arms around his employees and tell them he loved them, and he showed it by going to extraordinary lengths to help when any of his people faced health problems or financial difficulties. On the other hand, he could be brutal, not only with subordinates but also with his superiors, when they failed to meet his expectations. Many who began by hating him became his most devoted followers, sons of John, as they still call themselves in the Bureau. Others held their tongues and stood out of the way. Those who tried to keep pace with him would find themselves wondering what else they were willing to sacrifice, their marriages, their families, their private lives, everything except the Bureau. These were sacrifices O'Neill had made long before. O'Neill's tenure in the FBI coincided with the internationalization of crime and law enforcement. Since 1984, the FBI had exercised the authority to investigate crimes against Americans abroad, but that mandate had been handicapped by a lack of connection with foreign police agencies. O'Neill made a habit of entertaining every foreign cop or intelligence agent who entered his orbit. He called it his night job. In Clark's opinion, O'Neill was like an Irish ward boss who governed through interlocking friendships, debts, and obligations. He was constantly on the phone, doing favors and massaging contacts, creating a personal network that would facilitate the Bureau's international responsibilities. Within a few years, O'Neill was perhaps the most widely known policeman in the world. He would also become the man most identified with the pursuit of Osama bin Laden. Few people in American law enforcement or intelligence, including O'Neill, had any experience with Islam or much understanding of the grievances that had already given rise to the attack on the World Trade Center and other plots against the United States. Indeed, in a country as diverse as America, the leadership of the FBI was stunningly narrow in its range. It was run by Irish and Italian Catholic men. The backgrounds of many agents in the Bureau, particularly in the upper ranks, were monotonously repetitive, very much like O'Neill's, Jersey Boys, or Philly, or Boston. They called each other by boyish nicknames, Tommy, Danny, Mickey, that they had picked up when they were altar boys or playing hockey for Holy Cross. They were intensely patriotic and were trained from childhood not to question the hierarchy. The Bureau's culture had grown up in the decades when the FBI was fighting the Mafia, an organization created by people from very similar origins. The Bureau knew its enemy then, but it was deeply uninformed about this new threat. The radical Islamists came from places few agents had ever been to or even heard of. They spoke a language that only a handful in the Bureau understood. Even pronouncing the names of suspects or informants was a challenge. It was hard to believe in those days that people who were so far away and so exotic posed a real threat. There was a sense in the Bureau that because they were not like us, they were not a very appealing enemy. What distinguished O'Neill early in his new posting was his recognition of the fact that the nature of terrorism had changed. It had gone global and turned murderous. In the recent past, terror in America had been largely a domestic product, produced by underground associations such as the Ku Klux Klan, the Black Panthers, or the Jewish Defense League. The Bureau had faced foreign elements before on American soil, notably the Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, FALN, a Puerto Rican independence group that carried out approximately 150 terrorist acts in the United States during the 70s and early 80s. But deaths from those attacks were accidental, or at least beside the point. O'Neill's realization, shared by few, was that the radical Islamist had a wider, dramatic vision that included murder on a large scale. He was one of the first to recognize the scope of their enterprise and their active presence inside the United States. It was O'Neill who saw that the man behind this worldwide network was a reclusive Saudi dissident in the Sudan with a dream to destroy America and the West. Early in O'Neill's career as the Bureau's counterterrorism chief, his interest in bin Laden became such an obsession that his colleagues began to question his judgment. O'Neill was separated from bin Laden by many layers of culture and belief, but he devoted himself to trying to understand this new enemy in the darkened mirror of human nature. They were quite different men, but O'Neill and bin Laden were well-matched opponents, ambitious, imaginative, relentless, and each eager to destroy the other and all he represented. On the other side of that mirror, bin Laden looked at America as something other than an ordinary country or even a superpower. He saw it as the vanguard of a global crusade on the part of Christians and Jews to crush the Islamic resurgence. Although he may not have read Samuel P. Huntington's 1993 treatise on the clash of civilizations, he seized the idea and would refer to it later in interviews, saying it was his duty to promote such a clash. History moved in long, slow waves, he believed, and this contest had been going on continuously since the founding of Islam. This battle is not between Al-Qaeda and the U.S., bin Laden would later explain. This is a battle of Muslims against the global crusaders. It was a theological war, in other words, and the redemption of humanity was at stake. In August 1995, bin Laden made a decisive break with his homeland. In what he labeled a frank manifesto, bin Laden attacked King Fahd directly in one of his faxed commentaries. This was ostensibly a response to the reshuffling of the Saudi cabinet the week before, which, like most political events in the kingdom, was designed to give the appearance of reform without any real change. In a lengthy preamble, bin Laden made a legalistic case based upon the Quran and the commentaries of Islamic scholars that the king himself was an infidel. The Takfiri influence is clear, although some of his argument was obscure and wild-eyed. For instance, bin Laden cited Article 9 of the Charter of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which was set up to resolve trade conflicts between Arab countries in the Persian Gulf. Article 9 states that the council will follow the rules of its constitution, international law and norms, and the principles of Islamic law. "What mockery of Allah's religion," bin Laden exclaimed. "You have put the Islamic law only at the end." But many of the points bin Laden made in his diatribe were already deeply believed by large numbers of Saudis and echoed the pleas that Islamic reformers had made in a far more polite petition, one that resulted in the imprisonment of several leading clerics. "The main reason for writing this letter to you is not your oppression of people and their rights," bin Laden began. "It's not your insult to the dignity of our nation, your desecration of its sanctuaries, and your embezzlement of its wealth and riches." Bin Laden gestured to the economic crisis that had followed the Gulf War, to the insane inflation, the overcrowding in the classroom, and the spread of unemployment. "How can you ask people to save power when everyone can see your enchanting palaces lit up night and day?" he demanded. "Do we not have the right to ask you, O king, where has all the money gone?" Never mind answering.
One knows how many bribes and commissions ended in your pocket. He then turned to the galling presence of American troops in the kingdom. It is unconscionable to let the country become an American colony, with American soldiers, their filthy feet, roaming everywhere for no reason other than protecting your throne and protecting oil sources for their own use, he wrote. These filthy infidel crusaders must not be allowed to remain in the Holy Land. The king's tolerance of man-made laws in the presence of infidel troops proved to bin Laden that the king was an apostate and must be toppled. You have brought to our people the two worst calamities, blasphemy and poverty, he wrote. Our best advice to you now is to submit your resignation. One can imagine the shock that such a letter must have visited on the Saudi people, much less the king. In a society where no one could speak freely, the thunder of bin Laden's language jolted and titillated his mute countrymen. But he did not call for revolution, although he accused several leading princes of corruption and incompetence. He was not asking for the overthrow of the royal family. Except for the king's abdication, he didn't propose any solutions to the problems he cited. He pointedly made no reference at all to Crown Prince Abdullah, next in line to the throne. Despite the incendiary tone of the document, it was essentially modest in its ambition. Bin Laden showed himself to be a loyal reformer with little to offer in the way of useful political ideas. His insurrectionary zeal was directed toward the United States, not toward his homeland. Many Saudis shared his hostility to the continuing American presence in the kingdom, especially after Dick Cheney's well-known pledge that they would leave. Ostensibly, the troops remained in order to enforce the UN-mandated no-fly zone over Iraq. By 1992, however, and certainly by 1993, there were enough new basing agreements in the region that the Americans could have withdrawn without jeopardizing their mission. But the Saudi bases were convenient and well-appointed, and there didn't seem to be a sufficiently pressing need to leave. The week following bin Laden's insulting letter to the king, Prince Naif announced the execution of Abdullah al-Hadaif. Hadaif, an Arab Afghan, was not under a death sentence. He had been given 20 years for spraying acid in the face of a security officer who was reputed to have been a torturer. The Saudis were now being advised by the former Egyptian minister of the interior, who had led a brutal crackdown on dissidents in his own country. There was a widespread feeling in the kingdom that the stakes had been raised and that this summary execution was a message to bin Laden and his followers. Hudayf's Arab-Afghan comrades, for their part, were calling for revenge against the regime. In downtown Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, on Telateen Street, across from the steakhouse restaurant, there was a communication center for the Saudi National Guard. The mission of the guard was to protect the royal family and enforce stability. Because those goals were also important to the United States, there was an agreement between the two countries that the U.S. Army, along with the Vanel Corporation, an American defense contractor, would train the guard in the monitoring and surveillance of Saudi citizens. Shortly before noon on November 13, 1995, Colonel Albert M. Bleakley, an engineer who had lived for 3 years in the kingdom, walked out of the center to his truck parked on the street outside. Suddenly, a hot blast blew him backward several feet. When he was able to stand, he could see a line of cars burning, including the demolished remnants of his Chevrolet Yukon. Why would my car blow up, he wondered. There are no bombs here. The assassins had parked a van containing 100 pounds of Semtex explosive outside the three-story building, which was now shattered and burning. Bleakley staggered into the ruin. He was bleeding from the neck and his ears were ringing from the deafening blast. 3 dead men lay in the snack bar, crushed by a concrete wall. 4 others were killed and 60 people injured. 5 of the dead were Americans. The Saudi government reacted by rounding up Arab Afghans and torturing confessions out of 4 men. 3 of the 4 suspects had fought in Afghanistan, and 1 had also fought in Bosnia. The purported leader of the group, Musleh al-Shamrani,
had trained at Al-Qaeda's Farouk camp in Afghanistan. The men read their nearly identical confessions on Saudi television, admitting that they had been influenced by reading bin Laden's speeches and those of other prominent dissidents. Then they were taken to a public square and beheaded. Although bin Laden never publicly admitted authorizing the attack or training the men who carried it out, he called them heroes and suggested they were responding to his fatwa urging jihad against the American occupiers. They have pulled down the disgrace and submissiveness off the forehead of their nation, he said. He noted the fact that the number of U.S. troops in the kingdom was reduced as a consequence, another proof of the truth of his analysis of American weakness. The summary executions foreclosed the opportunity of learning exactly what connections there were between Al-Qaeda and the perpetrators. Bin Laden himself privately confided to the editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi that he had activated a sleeper cell of Afghan veterans when the Saudi government failed to respond to his protest of American troops on Arabian soil. John O'Neill suspected that the executed men had nothing to do with the crime. He had sent several agents to try to question the suspects, but they had been executed before the Americans got the chance to talk to them. Whatever Al-Qaeda's actual connection to the attack, Prince Turki would later describe the National Guard bombing as bin Laden's first terrorist blow.
Chapter 12. The Boy Spies. Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president, is a squat, necklace man with a heavy lower lip that juts forward when he talks, fleshy cheeks, and thickly lidded eyes, like a clay rendering that has not been fully formed. He was 67 years old in 1995, but his wavy hair was dyed a brilliant black, and the billboards bearing his visage in Cairo showed a man 20 years younger, changelessness being the most obvious feature of his rule. He had stood beside Anwar al-Sadat on the reviewing platform when the assassin struck, and upon assuming the presidency, he declared a state of emergency that was still in effect 14 years later. His early efforts at liberalizing the political process were answered by the victories of the Muslim Brothers, and then by the terror campaign of the radical Islamists in the 90s. Mubarak showed himself to be as pitiless as the insurgents, but the violence had not yet reached its climax. In April, Egyptian intelligence learned that Zawahiri had chaired a meeting of al-Jihad in Khartoum that included leading members of the rival Islamic group, a troublesome development. The report said that the two organizations were working together to restart terror activities in Egypt, and that they were being aided by the Sudanese government, which was supplying them with arms and false papers. But as yet there was no word on how they would strike or where. Hassan al-Turabi's grand Islamist revolution had been stymied, unable to spread beyond Sudan. Egypt was, of course, the ultimate target, but Mubarak had the country in an iron grip. If he were eliminated, Zawahiri and the plotters reasoned, that would create a power vacuum, and in the upcoming parliamentary elections, alternative Islamist movements could take charge. Mubarak was flying to Addis Ababa on June 26 for a meeting of the Organization of African Unity. The Egyptian radicals had been anticipating this event for more than a year, placing members of the cell charged with carrying out the killing in the Ethiopian capital. Some of them married local women and ostensibly became a part of the community. Working with assassins from the Islamic group, Sudanese intelligence smuggled weapons into their embassy in Ethiopia. The leader of the plot was Mustafa Hamza, a senior Egyptian member of Al-Qaeda and commander of the military branch of the Islamic group. At a farm north of Khartoum, Zawahiri gave a motivational talk to the 9 terrorists who were going to carry out the plot, and then he went on to Ethiopia to inspect the killing ground. The plan was to station 2 cars along the airport road, the only route into the capital. When Mubarak's limousine approached the first car, the assassins would strike with automatic weapons and rocket-propelled grenades. If Mubarak escaped the first trap, another car would be waiting down the road. Mubarak's plane arrived an hour early, but delays in getting his entourage and bodyguards together gave the assassins time to get into place. The limousine appeared. The shooters opened fire, but the grenade launcher malfunctioned. Two of Mubarak's Ethiopian bodyguards were killed in the exchange, and five of the assailants. Mubarak probably saved his own life when he ordered his driver to return to the airport, thus avoiding the second ambush. Three of the assassins were captured and one fled back to Sudan. The Ethiopian police quickly pieced together the plot, exposing the complicity of the Sudanese government. The debacle led to a unanimous vote in the United Nations to impose stiff economic sanctions on Sudan. The Sudanese representative denied the charges, but the Sudanese delegation was already in disfavor, having been implicated only 2 years earlier in a plot to blow up UN headquarters, a part of the blind sheikh's plan to destroy New York City landmarks. The international community had had enough of Tarabi's revolution, but Tarabi managed to make things worse by praising the attempted murder of Mubarak. The sons of the prophet Moses, the Muslims, rose up against him, confounded his plans, and sent him back to his country, he said. As for his future relations with the Egyptian president, Tarabi remarked, I found the man to be very far below my level of thinking and my views, and too stupid to understand my pronouncements. There was a reckoning coming, as everyone knew. Mubarak's security forces fanned out all across Egypt, from the slums of Cairo to the mud-brick villages of the Upper Nile, to destroy the radical Islamist movement. Houses were burned. Suspects disappeared. Sometimes a mother was dragged out on the street and stripped naked, and her children were warned that she would be raped if their brother was not present the next time they came. Mubarak instituted an anti-terrorism law that made it a crime to even express sympathy for terrorist movements. Five new prisons were built to house the thousands of suspects that were rounded up, many of whom were never charged. To deal with Zawahiri, Egyptian intelligence agents devised a fiendish plan. They lured a 13-year-old boy named Ahmed into an apartment with the promise of juice and videos. Ahmed was the son of Mohammed Sharaf, a well-known Egyptian fundamentalist and a senior member of al-Jihad. The boy was drugged and sodomized. When he awakened, he was confronted with photographs of the homosexual activity and threatened with the prospect of having them shown to his father. For the child, the consequences of such a disclosure were overwhelming. It could even be that the father would kill him, a source close to Zawahiri admitted. Egyptian intelligence forced him to recruit another child, Musab, whose father, Abu al-Faraj, was also in al-Jihad and served as the treasurer for al-Qaeda. Musab endured the same humiliating initiation of drugs and sexual abuse and was forced to turn against his family. The agents taught the boys how to plant microphones in their own homes and photograph documents. A number of arrests followed because of the information produced by the boy spies. The Egyptian agents then decided to use the boys to kill Zawahiri. They gave Musab a bomb to place inside a 5-story apartment building where Zawahiri's family lived. But Zawahiri was not there, and Sudanese intelligence discovered the bomb. The other child, Ahmed, was in the hospital, suffering from malaria. He had not yet been revealed as a spy. His physician was Zawahiri, who visited him every day. The Egyptian agents learned from Ahmed what time to expect his doctor. The next day, an assassination team was waiting, but for whatever reason, Zawahiri didn't come. An even better opportunity arose, however. Egyptian intelligence learned of a meeting of al-Jihad's Shura Council. An agent gave Musab a suitcase bomb and instructed him to place it in the office where Zawahiri and his companions would be meeting. As the boy got out of the agent's car, however, both the Sudanese intelligence and Jihad security were waiting for him. The Egyptian agent sped away, leaving the boy to his fate. Al-Jihad and Sudanese intelligence quarreled over who would take custody of Musab. Finally, Zawahiri was allowed to question the boy. He promised to return him safely. He soon placed his young patient, Ahmed, under his arrest as well. Then Zawafri convened a Sharia court. Many members of al-Jihad and al-Qaeda objected to putting children on trial, saying it was against Islam. In response, Zawafri had the boys stripped naked to determine whether they had attained puberty, which they had. The helpless boys confessed everything. The court convicted them of sodomy, treason, and attempted murder. Zawafri had the boys shot. To make sure he got his point across, he videotaped their confessions and their executions, and distributed the tapes as an example to others who might betray the organization. When Tarabi and his people learned of the firing squad, they were incensed. The Sudanese government accused al-Jihad of behaving like a state within a state, and ordered Zawafri and his organization out of the country immediately. They did not even get time to pack. "All we did was to apply God's Sharia," Zawafri complained. "If we fail to apply it to ourselves, how can we apply it to others?" Al-Jihad scattered, mainly to Afghanistan, Jordan, and Yemen. Many members broke away, scandalized by the cold-blooded execution of the two young boys. In Zawafri's hands, al-Jihad had splintered into angry and homeless gangs. There were fewer than 100 members left in the organization, and many of the men were still trying to collect their families and their belongings from Khartoum. "These are bad times," Zawafri admitted in Yemen, where he had taken refuge. He confided to some of his colleagues that he was developing an ulcer. His disillusioned followers often reflected on the pronouncement made during the prison years by the man Zawafri betrayed, Major Issam al-Qamari, that some vital quality was missing in Zawafri. Qamari was the one who had told him, "If you are the member of any group, you cannot be the leader." That now sounded like prophecy. Zawafri had few resources remaining other than bin Laden's backing. He was determined to strike back quickly against the Egyptian authorities in order to redeem his reputation and keep the remnants of his organization intact. His views had undergone a powerful shift from those of the young man who spurned revolution because it was too bloody. He now believed that only violence changed history. In striking the enemy, he would create a new reality. His strategy was to force the Egyptian regime to become even more repressive, to make the people hate it. In this, he succeeded. But the Egyptian people did not turn to him or to his movement. They only became more miserable, more disenchanted, frightened, and despairing. In the game Zawafri had begun, however, revenge was essential. Indeed, it was the game itself. First actions often set the course of future events. On November 19, 1995, the 18th anniversary of Anwar al-Sadat's trip to Jerusalem, Zawafri's men bombed the Egyptian embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. Although the bombing was an al-Jihad operation, it would become the prototype of future al-Qaeda attacks, in terms of both the target and the means of destroying it. One of Zawafri's men, known as Abu Khabab, an Egyptian cab driver who had studied chemistry, had become an explosives instructor. He created a powerful new bomb. Two men approached the embassy, one of them carrying a Samsonite briefcase filled with weapons. He threw grenades to frighten off the security guards. A pickup truck packed with a 250-pound explosive rushed into the compound. Then the driver set off the bomb. The embassy crumbled. Many other buildings within a half-mile radius of the bomb were severely damaged. 16 people died, not counting the two suicide bombers, and 60 were wounded. This act of mass murder was al-Jihad's first success under Zawafri's administration. The bomb left the embassy's ruined building as an eloquent and clear message, Zawafri wrote in his memoir. Bin Laden had not approved the operation, however, nor was he happy about it. Pakistan still offered the best route into Afghanistan and until then had provided sanctuary to many Arab Afghans who had lingered after the war. Now the government rounded up nearly 200 of them and locked them in a waiting hall in Peshawar, pending deportation to their home countries. The authorities were surprised when bin Laden appeared at the wedding hall with airline tickets to Sudan for the detainees. He suddenly had on his hands a dedicated group of terrorists who were now dependent on him but loyal to Zawahiri. Zawahiri also alienated many of his remaining followers, who were alarmed both by the death of innocents and by the use of suicide bombers. These issues would always plague the conversation about the morality of global jihad. In responding to these objections, Zawahiri created the theoretical framework to justify the Islamabad bombing and similar al-Qaeda attacks that followed. He explained that there were no innocents inside the embassy. Everyone who worked there, from the diplomats to the guards, was a supporter of the Egyptian regime, which had detained thousands of fundamentalists and blocked the rule of Islam. Those who carried out the duties of the government must shoulder responsibility for its crimes. No true Muslim could work for such a regime. In this, Zawahiri was repeating the Takfir view that had been carried to its logical extreme in Algeria. Yes, he admitted, there might have been innocent victims, children, true believers, who also died. But Muslims are weak and their enemy is so powerful. In such an emergency, the rules against the slaughter of innocents must be relaxed. The question of suicide was even more problematic. There is no theological support for such an action in Islam. Indeed, it is expressly prohibited. Do not kill yourselves, the Quran states. The hadith, or sayings of the Prophet, are replete with instances in which Muhammad condemns the action. The specific punishment for the suicide is to burn in hell and to be forever in the act of dying by means of the same instrument that was used to take his life. Even when one of his bravest warriors was severely wounded in battle and hurled himself upon his own sword only to relieve his terrible suffering, Muhammad declared that he was damned. A man may do the deeds of the people of the fire while, in fact, he is one of the people of paradise, and he may do the deeds of the people of paradise when, in fact, he belongs to the people of fire, the Prophet observed. Verily, the rewards of the deeds are decided by the last actions. In his defense of the bombing, Zawahiri had to overcome this profound taboo. The bombers who carried out the Islamabad operation, Zawahiri said, represent a generation of mujahideen that has decided to sacrifice itself and its property in the cause of God. That is because the way of death and martyrdom is a weapon that tyrants and their helpers, who worship their salaries instead of God, do not have. He compared them to the martyrs of early Christianity. The only example he could point to in Islamic tradition was that of a group of Muslims, early in the history of the faith, who were captured by idolaters and forced to choose between recanting their religion or being killed by their captors. They chose to become martyrs to their beliefs. It was, Zawahiri argued, a suicidal choice. Other Muslims did not condemn them at the time because they were acting for the glory of God and the greater good of Islam. Therefore, anyone who gives his life in pursuit of the true faith, such as the bombers in Islamabad, is to be regarded not as a suicide who will suffer the punishment of hell, but as a heroic martyr whose selfless sacrifice will gain him an extraordinary reward in paradise. With such sophistry, Zawahiri reversed the language of the Prophet and opened the door to universal murder. "Do you remember that chap, bin Laden?" Hassan al-Tarabi asked his son in early 1996. "Of course," Assam replied. "We're stable mates." "Some people in my party want to throw him out," said the father. When Assam next saw bin Laden, he was surprised at how depressed he appeared. Zawahiri and al-Jihad had been expelled, removing the Egyptian core of bin Laden's organization, and he was crippled by the loss. The relaxed and playful character Assam had known was gone. Rumors were racing through Khartoum that bin Laden was the next Carlos. The Sudanese government had allowed French intelligence to kidnap Carlos the Jackal, while he was undergoing an operation on his right testicle. Now Sudanese intelligence cleverly put out a false story that the French had issued a similar indictment for bin Laden, intending, no doubt, to scare him out of the country. Without the Egyptians, bin Laden was isolated and uncertain. There was no one he could trust. He knew that something might happen to him. He was already looking for another sanctuary, just in case. "You shouldn't leave Sudan," Assam advised his friend. "If you go, who is going to manage your investments?" Bin Laden had no answer. Assam pitied his predicament. He knew how merciless Sudanese politics could be, especially to a naive foreigner with much to lose. "I love that man by that time," Assam said, "because of so many ideas I see in him. There was no hypocrisy in his character, no divergence between what he says and what he does. Unfortunately, his IQ was not that great." The catastrophe that the radical Islamist leaders of Sudan had created for themselves finally made itself starkly apparent. The government's complicity in the terror plots against New York and the attempted assassination of Mubarak guaranteed international sanctions, which took effect in April 1996. By that time, the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum had already moved its American staff, along with the CIA's Khartoum station, to Kenya. It was part of a general withdrawal of the diplomatic community. Sudan was being pushed into the freezer, and its leaders were struggling to find a way out. On his final night in Sudan, the American ambassador, Timothy Carney, had dinner with the Sudanese vice president, Ali Othman Taha. They discussed what Sudan could do to improve its reputation. Sending Osama bin Laden back to Saudi Arabia was one of Carney's suggestions. He had already spoken to a senior Saudi official who had assured him that bin Laden could still return to the kingdom if he apologizes. A month later, the Sudanese Minister of State for Defense, Major General El-Fateh Urwa, met Carney and covert operatives of the CIA in a Rosslyn, Virginia hotel room. Urwa communicated his government's desire to get off the State Department's list of state sponsors of terror. He wanted a written checklist of measures that would satisfy the U.S. government. The CIA responded with a memorandum, which, among other things, proposed that Sudan turn over the names of all the mujahideen that bin Laden had brought into that country, along with their passport numbers and dates of travel. In later meetings, the Americans pushed the Sudanese representative to expel bin Laden. Urwa told the agency that it was better for him to stay in Sudan, where the government could keep an eye on him. However, he said, if the United States wanted to bring charges against bin Laden, we are ready to hand him to you. The Clinton administration still perceived bin Laden as a wealthy nuisance, not a mortal threat. His name had arisen as a financier of terror mainly because of his support of the blind sheikh. There was a consensus that he needed to be pushed out of his sanctuary in Sudan because the country was overrun with Islamic terrorists, and they were far more dangerous with money than without. There was no real debate about the consequences of expelling him, however. Nor was there any point in forcing Sudan to hand him over to U.S. authorities, because there was no evidence so far that he had harmed American citizens. Administration officials briefly nurtured the fantasy that the Saudis would accept their wayward son and simply cut off his head. The president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, went to the kingdom on Hajj, and while he was there he met with Crown Prince Abdullah. Bashir offered to turn over bin Laden if the Saudis would guarantee that he would not be imprisoned or prosecuted. The Crown Prince rejected those terms. The Egyptian government, which held bin Laden responsible for financing the attempted assassination of Mubarak, also pressured the Saudis to bring bin Laden to justice. This time, it was Prince Turki who demurred. There was no solid proof that bin Laden was involved in the operation, he contended. Ahmed Badib, Turki's deputy, privately told the Egyptians, "Give us proof and we will kidnap him." But the Saudis made it obvious to everyone that they were washing their hands of bin Laden. Bin Laden wasn't yet a wanted man, but he certainly was an unwanted one. The Americans continued pushing the Sudanese government. Ask him to leave the country, they told General Urwa. Just don't let him go to Somalia. He will go to Afghanistan, Urwa warned. Let him, the Americans responded. Hassan al-Turabi and bin Laden argued heatedly late into the night over a period of 3 consecutive days. Bin Laden said that after all he had invested in the country, the government had no right to throw him out. He had committed no crimes against Sudan, and there was no other place in the world that was ready to receive him. Turabi replied that bin Laden had only 2 choices, to leave or to remain and keep his mouth shut. Bin Laden said he couldn't remain silent as long as young Islamists were unjustly imprisoned in Saudi Arabia. Finally, he agreed to leave. But where in the world could he go? He no longer had a Saudi passport, which gave him entry anywhere in the world. Now he was traveling as a rather notorious Sudanese businessman and alleged sponsor of terror. Some members of al-Jihad offered to arrange for him to have plastic surgery and then smuggle him into Egypt. But Zawahiri, who reportedly was lying low in Bulgaria, advised against it. He had always maintained that Egypt was too transparent and lacked the natural retreats, caves, mountains, where a revolution could nurture itself. Somalia was a possibility, but the hostility of the local population toward the Arabs made the country too untrustworthy. As the Sudanese had warned, Afghanistan was the most obvious destination, perhaps the only one. Turabi did bin Laden the favor of calling the Sudanese ambassador to Afghanistan to ease bin Laden's return. Then the rulers of Sudan sat down to divvy up bin Laden's investments. The government still owed him for the $20 million, 450-mile highway from Khartoum to Port Sudan. Bin Laden had agreed to accept the tannery, which the government valued at $5 million, as partial payment, but now he had to suffer the indignity of selling it back to the government at a fraction of its worth. He liquidated his other businesses as quickly as possible, hoping to regain some portion of his fortune, but he was forced to virtually give away nearly everything he owned. The government confiscated his heavy equipment, the caterpillars, steamrollers, and cranes that were the key assets of his construction company, worth approximately $12 million by themselves. The spreading acres that he had cultivated with so much anticipation and pleasure were snatched away for next to nothing. He sold his horses to Hassam for a few $100s. The net loss, he ruefully admitted, was more than $160 million. Turabi's Islamist party, bin Laden concluded, was a mixture of religion and organized crime. The imminent departure of its leader threw al-Qaeda into a panic. Some members were invited to join bin Laden in Afghanistan in the future. Others were told the organization could no longer support them. Each of them got a check for $2,400 and a plane ticket home. Having shorn bin Laden of most of his net worth, the Sudanese government thoughtfully chartered him an antique Soviet Tupolev jet. Saif al-Adl, later to become al-Qaeda's military chief, sat in the co-pilot's seat holding a map so he could direct the Russian pilot, who didn't speak Arabic and whom they didn't trust. 2 of bin Laden's young sons, Saad and Omar, were with him, and a couple of bodyguards. Bin Laden left on May 18, 1996. His family was scattered and broken. The organization that he had built was torn apart. He held America responsible for the crushing reversal that had led him to this state. Chapter 13. Hijra. Sudan was behind him. Bin Laden flew across the bright, narrow sea, and soon Jeddah and Mecca passed below, and the Al-Sarawat escarpment, and then the great yellow desert, marked only by the roads his father had built across it. He was 38 years old. He had been famous, a hero, and now he was a refugee, forbidden to touch down in his own country. He refueled in the United Arab Emirates, where he was briefly greeted by emissaries of the government who may have given him money. He had been rich all of his life. but he had poured his savings into poor investments, which were, in any case, essentially stolen from him. Now he accepted the charity of those who remembered his name. He flew over the suckling supertankers docked beside the massive refineries lining the port.